So I guess I'll try to be done by 10:30.
It says snack break at 10:30.
It does. That's weird. Okay.
So
all right.
We may all get up and go get snacks.
Okay.
That's
right. And I've asked Brad to write down names when they start going. Okay, well, let's go ahead and get started then. Before we start, I do want to just let people know that my style of presenting is very interactive, in that I very much appreciate people raising their hands to ask questions when the Spirit moves them. However, no, that does not apply to any ministers in the room, A. And B, I do reserve the right to move us along, obviously, if I feel the need to. In some ways, my presentation this morning really is on some of the basics of freedom and rationality. So I am anticipating that some of your deeply profound questions about all this stuff might very well be answered in subsequent presentations, or again, to be discussed amongst yourselves in discussion breakout groups. So there are times when I might say, let's save that for later for the discussion group, or I happen to know that Brad's going to be touching on that tomorrow, or what have you. All right. So, as I said, our theme for this year is freedom and rationality. And what I wanted to do today is start off with some basics. This is one of those topics that has all sorts of capabilities to go into all sorts of intricate details and questions about how freedom and rationality actually work. But I actually think it really is very, very important with this topic to start off with just some of the basics of why the Lord has given this to us. Why the Lord has given us freedom and rationality. So for the first half hour of my presentation, I'm going to just be reading some passages that you've probably heard before. None of this will probably be very new to you. But again, I still think it's very, very important. So when it comes to basics, I think that there's no passage that gets more basic in my mind than Divine Love and Wisdom number 47. A great place to start, for this topic of freedom and rationality. We read, "The essence of love is not to love self, but to love others, and through love to be conjoined with them. It is also the essence of love to be loved by others, for thus is conjunction achieved. Love consists in this, that its own should be another's, and in feeling the joy of another as joy in oneself. This is what it is to love." Has everybody read this passage before, most of us? A beautifully simple passage, and again, so basic. The Lord is love itself, and because he is love itself, he needs other people whom he can love, and whom he can be loved in return by as well. So for starters, if you understand this very simple concept, we can understand that when the Lord created the finite universe, I love thinking about the fact that one of his main goals in creating the universe was simply to create something that wasn't him. Right? He had to create something that was not him, that he could love outside of himself. So throughout the writings, we get all of these very, very interesting passages that talk about creation in these terms. And I'll just read a couple of my favorites here. "In the substances and matters of the earth, there is nothing of the divine in itself, but that they are devoid of all that is divine in itself." Divine Love and Wisdom. Another one. "That which is created in God from God is not continuous from him. For God is esse in itself, and in created things there is not any esse in itself. If there were in created things any esse in itself, this would be continuous from God. And that which is continuous from God is God." Right? So we're getting a little theoretical here, but the idea is he had to create something that wasn't continuous from him. Paul. Yeah, the very Latinate term, the being of God is a translation that's sometimes used. The very, where's the translation here? Being itself, existence itself. You know, if any of that exists within the finite created world, well, then it's just an extension of God. So all that has to be withdrawn. One of my favorites is this. Every created thing is finite. And this is a very interesting phrase, I find. God first rendered his infinity finite by means of substances emitted from himself, from which his nearest surrounding sphere, which constitutes the sun of the spiritual world, came into existence. And that then, through that sun, he perfected the other surrounding spheres, even to the outmosts, which consists of passive materials. And in this manner, by means of degrees, he rendered the world more and more finite. Kurt.
This word sphere is a word which people that have been in the New Church for a long time are familiar with. To most people, sphere means a bubble. But later translators now, like I'm a translator, and I think perhaps in today's world, we might be better to think of, use the word aura.
Aura, interesting.
Than sphere, because it's not a bubble. It's a
An I like that. So when God was ready to create, he went, right, home. Yeah, good point. And again, these are spheres extending beyond spheres. And again, we're sticking very theoretical at this point, but I just love this idea that the Lord was trying to make his infinite more and more finite as he was creating. Again, the point being so that he could have something outside of himself, something that was not finite in the end, that he could actually love and that could love him in return. Now, these passages so far have been talking about just the created world in general, but of course, one of the most important things that the Lord created was people, human beings, men and women. And so it's very interesting to me that this same language carries over when he talks about creating people. And this is a great passage. It is impossible for God to love others and to be loved reciprocally by others in whom there is anything of infinity. That is, anything of the essence and life of love in itself, or anything of the divine. So you guys don't have any of this stuff within you. For if there were beings having in them anything of the infinity, that is, of the essence and life of love in itself, that is, of the divine, it would not be God loving others, or loved by others, excuse me, but God loving himself. Consequently, there must be others in whom there is nothing of the divine in itself. All right? Now, I want to acknowledge at this point that this gets a little bit tricky, because if I were to ask you, so do you all believe that you have nothing of the divine in itself within you? Do you think that's a true statement?
I would say no, because...
Heresy! No. Out! No.
We come from the divine.
Right. So it kind of gets a little bit tricky. You know, do we have the divine within us or don't we? Well, interestingly, here's a little follow-up passage that kind of answers this question from the angelic perspective. We read, the angelic idea of this is that what is created in God from God is like that in man which has been derived from his life, but from which the life has been withdrawn. There's that interesting word, withdrawn, again. Which is of such a nature as to be in accord with his life, in harmony maybe, and yet it is not his life. The angels confirm this by many things which have existence in their heaven, where they say that they are in God, and God is in them, and still that they have in their esse, in their being, nothing of God which is God. So I don't even know if I can explain quite what that means, but you can sort of just see it's this sort of tricky balancing act. The angels acknowledge that the Lord is within them, because obviously we live, right? Because God is within us. And yet the angels are also so, so careful. They do not want to, for a second, make people think that they believe that You know, it's called this divine spark heresy in some places in the writings, where God is actually in their being, and so therefore they are at all an extension of God. The angels would say, no, 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 that's not true. Lisa?
Is that sort of like a painting, that if you make a painting, then you have yourself in the painting, but it's a separate?
Yeah, I kind of like that idea. It, and that painting, as I've used actually with kids before, would be created in the image of the artist. You could look at that painting and see the qualities of the artist within it, but it would not be the artist. So yeah, maybe that's a good analogy.
I think you can see an image of this, particularly when married couples who've been married for quite some time, they are so close they almost mirror each other. Mm. They are not each other, but they're, you know, they're like this.
They're close.
Yeah,
another good analogy. I like that. I sometimes tell other older students as well that, you know, that whole one angel thing with conjugal partners is, I don't want to say they don't really become one angel, because it does say that. But again, they don't meld into this oneness where they have no unique qualities anymore. It's so I like that analogy. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one more and then let's move on. Yes.
In their essay, second line from the bottom.
Yes, second line from the bottom.
They can adopt something from the divine and take it and acknowledge it, but it's not in themselves from their very being.
Yes. Yeah, and this is where I might, again, I did a paper once when I took a class at Boston College on comparative religions, and my end of the year paper was on comparing the new church with Buddhism. And this is one of the issues I kind of brought up with Buddhism, that, you know, this idea that we are one with everything. Yeah, the new church wouldn't quite phrase it that way, although there are some interesting parallels.
Yes.
I said one more, but one more. Go ahead. This is the real one. That's okay. It is. I'm going to bring up a passage a little bit later that points out, you know, the word I like to use is, it's a paradox in some ways, that our finite, pathetic little minds, I don't think will ever really completely be satisfied with the answer to. Well, what do you mean there is only one life, which is the Lord, and yet somehow he gave us the appearance that life is ours? But interesting, that word appearance is interesting. I mean, it's not ours, it's an appearance. So, again, and these are some of the things that over the few days we have here, we'll be getting into, I think, more and more. Now, when it comes to people, of course, the Lord's goal was not just to create people that were not him. And this is the way I've sort of been putting it so far. He wanted to create people that had the ability to love him in return. You know, in that first passage from DLW that we read, there's that beautiful idea that, you know, divine love wants to love others, but in order to be conjoined with them, it also wants to be loved in return. You know, it's an interesting thought that the Lord wants to be loved by you. And so I won't read it here, but we have this beautiful passage from John that is reminding us that when he created people that, yes, were not him, if you will, but people he wanted to have the ability to love him in return. Again, he who loves me shall be loved by my Father, and I will love him. There's that reciprocal relationship, I think, illustrated beautifully in this passage. Now, when it comes to this reciprocal relationship of love, this, to me, is where we really now get into this topic of freedom and rationality. Freedom and rationality, in some ways, are the gifts that the Lord has given you that allow you to do this. Freedom and rationality are the gifts that allow you to freely, of your own choosing, love the Lord in return, to reciprocate his love. Now, here's where it gets again a little frustrating as a presenter. There are just thousands, I can probably literally say, of great passages that talk about freedom and rationality. If any of you looked at your pre-camp material, I actually suggest today, if you have the time, just read the entire chapter in Divine Providence called Freedom and Rationality. You know, I maybe should just stand up here and read it. I could just read passage after beautiful passage that help us understand this concept of freedom and rationality. But two that are a bit long, but I think, again, beginning of camp, worth just reading, I think really nail down the concept of why these two things are so important. First one is Divine Love and Wisdom 15. Just come down here because I can't quite see. We read, conjunction is of the Lord with the angel and of the angel with the Lord. Conjunction, therefore, is reciprocal. It goes both ways. On the part of the angel, it is as follows. The angel, in like manner as man, has no other perception than that he is in love and wisdom from himself. Consequently, that love and wisdom are, as it were, his, or his own. Now, I'll pause there for a second. Notice it's a perception. Is that true, though? Is it our own? You could talk about that during your discussions. Unless he so perceived, there would be no conjunction. Thus, the Lord would not be in him, nor he in the Lord. Nor can it be possible for the Lord to be in any angel or man, unless the one in whom the Lord is, with love and wisdom, has a perception and sense as if they were his. By this means, the Lord is not only received, but also when received is retained, important word, and likewise loved in return. So I read this and it just strikes me that God has a tricky job. He's got to make us feel like something is 100% our own, which isn't. It's not. It's his. But the very gift of life is he wants it to feel as if it is our own. And then very much the next number, tying this in with freedom and rationality. It shall now be explained how it comes that an angel perceives and feels as his, and thus receives and retains that which yet is not his. Again, weird phrase. How am I, if I'm the Lord here, how am I going to make these people feel that this is theirs when it's not? Well, here's how he does it. The essence of the matter is this. Every angel has freedom and rationality. These two he has to the end that he may be capable of receiving love and wisdom from the Lord. Yet neither of these, freedom nor rationality, is his. They are the Lord's in him. But since the two are intimately conjoined to his life, so intimately that they may be said to be conjoined into it, they appear to be his own. It is from them that he is able to think and will and to speak and act. And what he thinks, wills, speaks, and does from them appears. Again, notice this word appears keeps coming up. Appears as if it were from himself. This gives him the ability to reciprocate, and by means of this, conjunction is possible. So any brief questions or thoughts about those two numbers? There's so many more, but I thought those kind of summed it up well. Lisa?
Yeah, but it's for us in the new church, we know this is going on. So we know that this is not, it's really the Lord, it's not of ourself, but we know we're under delusion, or not necessarily appearance, that it is our of ourself. In other words, we know that it's easier to look at other people and say, well, they don't know that, and they think it's of themselves. So I get confused sometimes, do I think about this as it's of myself, but I really know it's the Lord?
Yeah, that's a great question, and in some ways that is the same paradox I was talking about before, and this is perfect. This leads right into the next slide. Note the bit that I just turned into red there. We have these gifts, right? Yet neither of these, freedom nor rationality, is his. They are the Lord's in him. So to answer your question, whenever you are reading anything in the writings about freedom and rationality, I find it so interesting that the Lord is always sure to remind us or answer this very question for us. And he says that we need to act and live life as if they are our own. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit more in a minute. We've got to just take life by the by the horns and just live life as if it is our own. But we always have to be acknowledging at the same time that it is the Lord's, and that these gifts of freedom and rationality are not actually ours. They're the Lord's with us. Which is, I think, it's a very deep question and thought, but it's a fascinating one to ponder. Because I think often when we talk about freedom, especially maybe in like our North American independence, yay for individuals, country of America, you know, we love freedom and it's mine. Don't encroach on my freedom. But on a spiritual level, I think this, the red part of this passage invites us to not hold on to our freedom and rationality too tightly. Just to always recognize that, wow, thank you for this, but it's not mine. It's a gift from the Lord with me. Here's a great passage as well, something for discussion time. There's my falling angel. So far as an angel believes, and here's the answer to your question, Lisa. So far as an angel believes that love and wisdom are really in him, and thus lays claim to them for himself, as if they were his, so far the angelic is not in him, and therefore he has no conjunction with the Lord. For the sake of conjunction with the Lord, an angel has the ability to reciprocate, but that this ability in itself considered is not his, but the Lord's. From this it is that if he abuses his ability to reciprocate, by which he perceives and feels as his what is the Lord's, which is done by appropriating it to himself, he falls from the angelic state. So does everyone get what that's saying? Again, please, the Lord says, use these gifts of freedom and rationality, but you've got to always remember that they're mine. They're gifts. Don't try to, I love this phrase, claim to them for yourselves, lay claim. Jennifer.
You said that the Lord had a tricky job of getting us to feel that something that wasn't ours was ours, but I think he succeeded really well.
That's true. He did a good job. Well done.
The hard part is helping us remember this, that it's not ours, and keep remembering that, and stop being so caught up in ourselves. That's
yeah. Yeah, I find it is a very humbling thought that, again, we love freedom like it's mine. I think Brad might actually touch on this a little bit tomorrow, you know, this idea that freedom means I get to do whatever I want. The Lord gave me freedom, so, I'm my own person, that means. Well, no, it completely changes it when you realize, oh, wait a minute, even freedom is a gift from the Lord, and I've got to humbly acknowledge that. Yep, one more. Yeah, well, again, I go back to the word paradox. You know, don't go too far on either side of this equation. We're going to be reading a wonderful passage for actually our Holy Supper service where the Lord warns us, hey, if you sit there with your arms down just waiting for influx from me, waiting for me to solve all of your problems, it's not going to work. I've given you this gift of freedom and rationality so that, again, yes, acknowledge it's mine, but use these gifts. Think about things for yourself. You know, try to solve problems from your own perspective. Not your own perspective. We always have to do it going to the Lord's word, of course. But, you know, we use these gifts as our own. Where are we here? Okay. Good. Half an hour. So I want to shift gears here a little bit now. So that was sort of my introduction, just reminding us of, you know, why freedom and rationality in general are so important to the Lord. I want to shift now and talk about how the Lord maintains our freedom and rationality. Would anybody like to attempt to define for us deism? What is deism? Go ahead, Stephen, you can talk now. Not to put you on the spot. I could have a Wikipedia, you know, definition here. So what's deism? Anybody? Yes. You agree with Wikipedia, so you must be right. Oh, did you write that article? Oh. Wikipedia puts it this way. I'm on the wrong page. Deism is the belief that God has created the universe, so that's good. Thumbs up for the deists. But remains apart from it and permits his creation to administer itself through natural laws. So in other words, God created it, and as he created it, he created the natural world with these laws, you know, Newton's laws and all sorts of other laws, gravity and et cetera, et cetera. And once he created it, he kind of looked at it and said, okay, great, I've created this wonderful thing. I've given it these laws so it can function on its own, basically. And I'm done now. I'll go stand over here and let creation kind of just go on by itself. Are you disagreeing with me, Anna? Am I wrong? Sorry. You looked like you were like saying to your mom, no, that's not right. Don't tell me I'm wrong in front of everybody, though. Wait till later. What was I saying? Sorry. Deism. Now, that is not true. The writings very clearly teach us that, you know, yes, the Lord maybe created the world at some point in time and space, but that's a conversation for another day. But maintenance, preservation of his creation, we're told, is perpetual creation. I love that new church phrase, that the Lord didn't create and then step back, as the deists might say. The Lord is perpetually creating. If the Lord were ever to just step back from his creation, it would all just collapse. So the Lord never withdraws. He's always there, perpetually maintaining and preserving the things that he has created. Now, a neat thought to myself is that I would like to invite you to think about that in terms of freedom and rationality as well. You know, sometimes when it comes to freedom, I think we think of it as something that the Lord just sort of gave us and now has sort of said, okay, now run with it. You know, Jamie, here you go, you're free. Now go live. But really, I think it's better to think of it in terms of the Lord perpetually trying to maintain us in this state of freedom and rationality. So what I'd like to do with my remaining time here is just present three different ways that the Lord works to maintain our freedom and rationality. Now, I warn you, I know I've made a mistake here. Each of these three things should be a lecture in themselves. So we're going to be moving through these rather quickly, but I wanted to do this because I think this is where this topic now starts to get a little bit more practical. You know, why does it really matter that we understand that the Lord is always trying to maintain this freedom and rationality within us? And I think these are three kind of neat ways to think about how the Lord does this. So the first way he maintains our freedom and rationality on one level is by permitting some evils. There's a great principle that the writings lay out in conjugal love, and I'll just read it here. Because there is no freedom to turn in one direction, unless there is as well the same freedom to turn in the other, as it is impossible to weigh anything in a balance, unless the scales are able in equilibrium to incline to either side, so man has no freedom in accordance with reason to move in the direction of good unless he has the freedom in accordance with reason to move in the direction of evil. As freely in the direction of the infernal atmosphere, which is one of adultery, as in the direction of the heavenly atmosphere, which is one of marriage. And again, that's just one example with marriage and adultery, but the principle holds true across the board. Great passage that says that, look, if you want to be free to go towards the Lord, you've got to also be free to head away from him. All right, questions about that? Is that pretty straightforward? I don't know that I want to sit here and keep reading, so I'll just sort of let you peruse that on your own. Another great passage that puts this in terms of kind of what Brad was actually talking about in worship this morning, heavenly freedom versus hellish freedom. I won't go into the details, but the Lord must allow us to have some level of hellish freedom if he's also going to allow us to have heavenly freedom. We need that. Otherwise, we really can't freely, as if from ourselves, choose what is good, if we don't also have that ability to choose what is evil. So again, in a nutshell, I would argue that, you know, one of the ways the Lord maintains our freedom and rationality is sometimes he's got to just permit evil in this world, you know, so that people are free to either turn towards him or not. And again, you can see that could be a whole topic on its own. Sorry, Jennifer, I know that upsets you, but he does have to allow it. What else about this? One thing I do like to point out about this topic is that this does not mean that the Lord permits all evils. You know, let's recognize that as we talk about this idea that the Lord permits evil, it's some evils. The Lord still is in control, and there are lots of evils that the Lord doesn't permit because he foresees that it is not conducive to the end goal, which is salvation. I also like to point out, and again, Brad, I apologize, I'm stepping on your toes a little bit here. It says at the end of this passage that these things are affected principally in man's interior will, and from this is in his interior thought. So, you know, the Lord permits certain evils when it comes to us willing evil and thinking false and evil things. As Brad will tell us tomorrow, that doesn't mean that we are allowed to, though, do evil things all of the time. There's a big difference there. So, Eric, let's get a couple questions here, and then I'll move on to the next one. Let me think about that for a second. Actually, could you hold off on that? Because actually the next point, I think, touches on that a little bit more. Rachel.
What's an example of...
I don't know, because he didn't permit it. I guess what I mean by that is, I forget who it was, but somebody once planted the idea in my head that, you know, sometimes we look out into the world and we can get depressed because of all the evil that we see going on out there. And one thought that somebody once gave me was, well, think about, though, all the things that, thankfully, the Lord has not permitted. In other words, kind of the idea that it could be a lot worse, and that isn't it amazing that, yeah, granted, you watch the news, and, you know, it's very easy to get depressed about all these bad things we see going on in the world, but you know what? We're surviving. You know, there are a lot of things that he obviously hasn't permitted, otherwise society as a whole would collapse. And again, you could argue with me about that, because let's look at some pretty horrific things that are going on in the world. But I think it's just this idea that, again, I didn't read it, so I just will. The divine providence continually grants permission for the sake of the end and permits such things as pertain to the end and no others. Right, so he's not going to necessarily permit that. It's not that the Lord's sitting up there and going, okay, sorry guys, for the sake of freedom and rationality, anything goes. It's just that, no, it's this balancing act where he has to permit certain evils for the sake of the end. But again, my point is simply that it's not just a free-for-all, sorry, I've got to permit it all. Pete. Yeah.
And so, you know, even if it's somebody contemplating doing evil, somebody's on the other side trying to thwart it.
Yes.
Police force kind of thing. So I think it all balances out in that way. But he's pretty good at creating good things happening.
Yep. A word that came to mind as you were saying that is just the Lord's gravity is always pulling us towards what is good. So even though he's permitting these things, he's always trying to bend it. Another phrase that comes to mind, he's bending what is evil towards what is good. You know, again, never just letting it happen without a reason or without a purpose.
Each
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad.
That doesn't seem fair. Yeah. Some people have to undergo this.
I'm glad you said that. I always find that this topic gets harder and harder to understand when you think about the world as a whole. But as soon as you start, just ignore all that for a minute and think about your own life, I think you could perceive more how the Lord is constantly working to, yep, I'm sorry, I've got to just allow Rachel to, you know, sometimes do things I don't want her to do, but I'm always, though, trying to lead her back, sorry to pick on you here, to lead her back to what is good, you know, and to what is right. Okay, let's move on to the next one. So again, like you can see, all of these are lectures in themselves. My goal here is just to kind of get you thinking about these things that, oh yeah, the Lord is preserving our freedom and rationality by sometimes just the fact that he's got to permit evil to happen. So my next one here is actually sort of one of my favorites. The Lord maintains our freedom and rationality by keeping his providence hidden. I love this topic. Providence is one of those things that so often we think of it in terms of how absolutely wonderful it would be if the Lord would only make his providence better known to us. You know, I'm struggling in my life. I don't know what to do in this situation. Lord, if only you would appear to me, show me that you're here, show me that you're guiding me, tell me what to do, life would just be wonderful. Can anybody give me the quick 10-second answer for why that would not be wonderful? Having to do it with freedom and rationality. Yes, exactly right. It has to do with the fact that our finite minds do not come close to understanding how present the Lord actually is with us. We cannot begin to fathom how intricately the Lord's divine providence is involved with every single particular piece of your life. If we were to see how close the Lord was, we would absolutely hate it. It would be like mom and dad, sorry mom, following us everywhere. You know, I go to the movies and there's mom and dad right behind me. Yeah. I go to the bathroom, you're in the bathroom with me. You know, it's just, we would not like it. So here's the great passage that, you know, just phrases it for us very nicely. A person would have no liberty to act according to reason, and nothing would appear to him to be as from himself, if he perceived and felt the operation of the divine providence. Since if he perceived and felt it, he would also be led by it. That's a little bit confusing. Don't we want to be led by the divine providence? So what's that saying? Rachel? Yes. Yep. Yep, that's exactly what it is. So in this case, it's we would be led by it, I think, just sort of bound by it, you know, without freedom. It would just sort of push us along because it would be so blatant that it was there and leading us. Did I hear something else over here? So just continuing, for the Lord leads all by means of his divine providence, and it is only an appearance that a man leads himself. Interesting. Therefore, if a person had a lively perception and feeling of being led, he would not be conscious of life. And he would then be moved to utter sounds and to act much like a graven image. If he were still conscious of life, he would be led like one bound hand and foot, or like a beast of burden yoked to a cart. Who does not see that a person would then have no freedom? So again, I hope you see that these things are a sign of getting us to see how practical this topic really is. Oh yeah, the Lord cares so much about our freedom and rationality. You know what? This is one of the reasons why he kind of works behind the scenes. And even when we're sitting there begging him to make his providence more known to us. He's, you know, it's probably, he feels bad for us. You know, it's like a kid begging you for something that you know isn't good for them. You feel bad as a parent not giving them the second chocolate bar or whatever. But the Lord just knows that if he made his presence more and more felt, it would take away this vital, vital gift of freedom and rationality. Eric, to your question, and I want to move along here to make sure we get to the last one, but it's interesting that the Lord also says that this is why we are not given a knowledge of future events. And here's one where I found it interesting that he talks a little bit more about the reason side of this equation. You know, when it comes to the future, one of the things that we love to do as human beings, that one of the things that makes us free, is that we get to use that rational mind to try to figure out how to achieve the things that we want to achieve in life, right? I want to have, to go back to that other passage, a good marriage. I want to go to heaven. And part of life is the enjoyment of now rationally trying to figure out how to get there. So this passage points out that if we had a knowledge of future events, that reasoning process would just stop. And I think we can all see that that's true. You know, and I like to use the example of finding, you know, your conjugal partner as a young adult. You know, wouldn't it be great if the Lord just pointed and said, there he is, or there she is. But there's this great passage in conjugal love that says, no, that's not how it works. Because if the Lord did that, you then would no longer have to do the work to try to court this young woman if you're a man, or, you know, to respond to this courtship if you're a young woman. It would just be like, you knew it would happen. So all your freedom, your kind of work to get it would kind of go by the wayside. And I'm sure there are other great examples of that as well. You know, he would no longer think from his interior self, I love this bit, how he should act or how he should live in order to meet the event, but he would only think from his exterior self that he was meeting it. So again, I know it's going to happen, so I don't have to worry about it anymore. Nina.
I just want to make sure you guys all know that this fall's journey program is called Living Gratefully, but it's about the laws of providence. So if this is fun for you,
cool,
join the journey group and go to this sermon series, because it's all about
it. It's all about this. Great. Yeah, that's a great segue, because again, like I said, this is all just bits and pieces. I wish I could do a whole talk on just this.
See, Jacob's Creek's on the cutting edge.
Yes. So one more, and then I'll move on here. Yes. That is another great, great point, and the Divine Providence makes that very point as well. There's a great chapter, I should actually email it to you guys if you're interested in pursuing this further. Another reason he keeps his providence hidden, and I love this part, it really makes me laugh when I think about it, is because the Lord's leading us somewhere where we don't want to go. Our hellish nature is to incline towards evils of every kind, and I know all of us would probably sit here and like to think that we're lovely people who, oh, if the Lord told me where I was going to, yes, I would follow him and butterflies and rainbows would be surrounding me as I did, and puppy dogs too. But the fact of the matter is our selfish will is dragging us this way. The Lord in his providence is gently trying to lead us this way. And again, if we saw that he was leading us here, we would go kicking and screaming in the other direction. So
we may also want to take a shortcut and not realize that the long journey takes 10 other people with us.
Yes, exactly. Right, yeah, all these are great points. So again, you could see the Lord maintains our freedom and rationality by keeping his providence hidden. And again, I think very practical truth to reflect on. So, okay, go ahead.
Just very quickly.
Mm.
So we can acknowledge and rationally see this is what the Lord's want, but as to our daily lives, we don't feel him
sucking you in. Yeah, that's a good point. I would maybe qualify that a bit and suggest that even seeing where he wants us is, I think, fair to say it's a general seeing. Like, he wants us in heaven. He's not going to tell us what particular heaven, though, you're going to end up in, because that also would take away a little bit of your use of your rational mind to figure out what you want to do with your life. Now, that sort of ties in with the last one. So we've got 5 minutes here left, so let me rush through this a little bit. Because in some ways, the last one very much ties into this, but it's a little bit different. The Lord maintains our freedom and rationality by encouraging us to think and to act for ourselves. Now, if you read through the scriptures, it is very, very true that there are times when the Lord clearly presents to us what is right and wrong. So again, I don't want to give you the idea that life is just this big, gray, mushy pudding that we have to wade our way through. There's right and wrong, there's black and white, and I think that sometimes as finite human beings who want to get away with things that we shouldn't be getting away with, we like to make gray matters out of what is actually black and white. But given that that is true, it is so interesting to me that throughout the scriptures, you'll actually find the Lord often not simply telling you what to do. More often, the Lord actually invites you to think about something or to consider something for yourself. It's like he's sitting there saying, I'm not going to tell you exactly what to do in this situation. I am going to give you some principles that you can think about from my word. And then I want you to use your own mind, your own rationality, to process it. Think about it. Try to apply it to your lives for yourself, because I need you to do that, again, so that you have this sense that life is your own. I could give you lots of examples from the scriptures where, again, the Lord doesn't say, do this. Instead, he says, you might want to consider this in your decision-making process. One of my favorites, though, that I have to admit that I'm stealing this from my colleague, Dan Goodenough, who gave a great presentation at our clergy meetings about freedom and the sense that life was our own. And he brought this wonderful passage to our attention. The Lord was talking with a group of people, as he often did, teaching them, reading from the scriptures. And suddenly, two brothers approached him. And this is in part funny to me that, because, man, these people are natural. The Lord's trying to teach them very spiritual things. And here these two clowns come and ask him. Then one of the crowds said to him, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. It's like, okay. Notice how the Lord responded. But Jesus said to him, man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you? He wasn't going to sit there and on that level tell them exactly what to do. Instead, he gave them a principle on which they could act. He said, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. So again, as Dan was saying when he was presenting to us, isn't this sort of neat where we have this situation where the Lord is not going to tell us exactly what to do in a given situation. He's going to give us a principle from his word, and then invite us to think about it for ourselves and to sort of process through what the best decision is going to be. We might sometimes get it wrong, but again, that process is really, really important. One other story that I'd like to sort of end with here. Does anybody know what that's a picture of? The story from the word? Yes, it is Aaron in front of the Pharaoh turning his staff into a serpent. Do you remember this? Now talk to me after this presentation, because my father-in-law pointed out that that is a horrible translation. That was more of a water serpent or a dragon type thing that this staff turned into. It wasn't just this cute little garter snake.
That looks like a cobra.
That looks like a cobra, so I don't know that that's a great picture. So yes, Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a water serpent. Now, does anybody remember, though, what happened immediately after this? Aaron throws down his rod, it becomes a serpent. Pharaoh and his magicians walk in, take their rods, and in a sense, oh, we can do that. But Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, so the magicians of Egypt. They also did in like manner with their enchantments, for every man threw down his rod, and they became water serpents. Let me just read for you an absolutely fantastic passage from the Arcana Celestia that explains why the Lord allowed this to happen. And we're closing up here, so I'll just go ahead and read this. It is according to the laws of order that no one ought to be persuaded about truth in a moment. That is to say that truth should be so confirmed in a moment as to leave no doubt whatever about it. Because the truth, which is so impressed, becomes persuasive truth and is devoid of any extension and also of any yielding quality. And then notice this. Hence it is that as soon as in the other life any truth is presented before good spirits by a manifest experience, there is soon afterwards presented something opposite which causes doubt. In this way, it is given them to think about it and to consider whether it be so and to collect reasons and thus to bring that truth into their minds rationally. This is the reason why the magicians were allowed to do as Aaron did, for thereby doubt was excited among the sons of Israel about the miracle, whether it was divine, and thus an opportunity was given them of thinking and considering whether it was divine and of finally confirming themselves, that's the key word there, themselves, that it was so. I find this such an interesting passage. It's such an interesting reality to consider that sometimes your freedom and rationality is so important to the Lord that he is going to allow contrary ideas to the truth to come before you. Why? So that you're almost forced to think about this a little bit more deeply. You know, if you were to just hear the truth and, oh, I accept it instantly, well, no. I want you to chew this over a little bit more and really think about it. So again, he allows these sort of doubting ideas to seep into our minds at times. Again, that idea that he wants us to think for ourselves as a way of maintaining our freedom and rationality. We are at 10:30, so I'm going to be a good presenter and just flash before your eyes. Go if you have to, have kids and stuff to get to. But let me give you one last thing to think about during your discussion groups. How does this affect the way we view and treat others? In just a moment, I have got some handouts that I'm going to give you. You all will be invited to go off to wherever you'd like to go in small groups and discuss what I have presented to you today. You do not have to discuss these questions if you don't want to. But these are just some suggestions of things you could talk about. One of the things on this list is to think about how what I have presented to you today affects the way we view the freedom and rationality of other people. I wish it wasn't 10:30 because I had some things I wanted to say about that. But I will just, you know, leave you with that question. Come back for the second talk and I might have time for it. But think in your discussion groups about, okay, the Lord wants us to have freedom and rationality. Do you respect your neighbor's freedom and rationality as much as the Lord does? How does this affect the way we present the truth of our church to people? You know, questions like that. So I've got to stop though, so thank you very much for listening. And at this point, I'm going to hand out these questions. And Jamie, am I right? There's a coffee break. Snack break, and then you can pick up these and go have a discussion on this stuff on your own. Thank you very much.